This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Dr. David Thomas held many roles over the course of his 20 years in law enforcement. He was a patrol officer, detective. He served in the Street Crimes Division, SWAT, hostage negotiations, community policing, and he trained other officers in many of these roles. Dr. Thomas is also a certified expert in the use of force, and his research interests focus on police ethics, victimology, serial homicide, and inmate populations. After leaving the force, he got a PhD in forensic psychology from the Union Institute. And these days, he's a justice studies professor at Florida Gulf Coast University. He's also the author of a new book called The State of American Policing, Psychology, Behavior, Problems, and Solutions, which caught our attention. Dr. Thomas joins us from the studios of WUFT Public Broadcasting in Gainesville, which is where he actually lives. Dr. Thomas, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And as always, we invite you to join our conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Thomas, you're in Gainesville, but you teach down here in FGCU. How do you do that?
Well, originally, I moved when I got the job about 14 years ago, and I was always coming back to Gainesville because my wife lives here. So what they decided to do was originally we started to one day a week I had to be on campus. And I'm an old timer now, so I get to do everything from the house and teach online.
Well, the joys of technology, right?
Absolutely.
So let's go back to the beginning. You grew up in Detroit?
Yes, ma'am.
You write in your book that you grew to hate police as a kid. What was going on?
Well, every encounter I had with the police was negative, probably from the time that I was 10. You know, I lived through the 67 riots, which were quite a division inside the city between white and black. And during that time, I can recall, even in the book I talk about it, where I walked up to a patrol car. I was always fascinated with police. So I walked up to a patrol car and asked an officer, you know, a simple question, how fast does the car go? And he stuck his nickel-plated 357 Magnum in my face and told me to get away from the patrol car. And it was from that point on, it was almost like every encounter. When I was in middle school, on my way home, I got stopped, put in the back of a patrol car, taken in an alley and beat up and pushed outside the patrol car, and they drove off. And then later, when I was after I graduated from high school, I was stopped again. I just left the gym. I looked in my rearview mirror. It was the unmarked patrol car behind me, and it was snow. They pulled me out of the car, put me on the ground, so I looked like a robbery suspect, had a shotgun in my head, tore my dad's car apart, and then they just got back in their car and they drove off. So that was kind of my my penchant and my hatred for police.
Yeah, okay, so then you decided to become one?
It's an interesting concept. I grew up in Michigan, so about the time the whole auto industry had gone belly up, and so did the state. The only jobs that were available as I was graduating from college were law enforcement jobs, and so that's why I decided to become a police officer. The idea was that my dad had always instilled in me that you should get a job where you have a pension and there's some longevity, mm-hmm. and a future. And so that was the only thing available, and that's actually why I started. After I got started, I fell in love with the profession.
So how were you treated when you initially went to, I guess, would it be police academy?
The police academy was an interesting dynamic. I was the second black conservation officer hired in the state of Michigan. And being from Detroit, the state of Michigan sent us to a police academy that was in Marquette in Northern Michigan University. I was the first black to attend that academy. And while I was there, I can recall the students, some of the white students came to me and told me if I ever got in trouble, I would be on my own.
Well, that's real comforting.
It was.
But you decided to go ahead and stick with it. I can't imagine what dialogue you had to have in your head to make yourself stay there and stick to it.
Well, to quit, being the first at anything, to quit would mean it's an example that you set for other people that are to follow. And so the idea is you stick it out and you see where it takes you, and that's exactly what I did. And that's why I ended up staying.
Were there any people back then that were allies at all? Like we call them today, allies, people that are of a different race who stuck by you anyway?
Sure. And one of them was a field training officer. And I remember that once out of the academy and I had, you know, we had different training stations in the state. And the state of Michigan, the Department of Conservation, what they were trying to do is they were trying to diversify the force all the way around. And I remember they called in, they would call in all the conservation officers from around the state. And we literally would have a training session, a 1 week long training session, do half one week and the other half of the officers the other week. During that information, EEOC came up and talked about how they were trying to diversify the force. Interestingly enough, it became very negative and it became very racial. With some of the officers using the N-word and asking, why do we have to hire those people, on and on and on. So I got up and I walked out.
I mean, you're like, I'm right here.
Yeah. I didn't exist. One of my training officers, unbeknownst to me, actually stood up after I left and came to my defense. And he explained to them that with my background in psychology, you know, the way I treated people, that I had done a better job than most of those guys. He had worked with every one of them that they had ever done in their career. So you need to, you know, kind of back up and just give people a chance. So that was the first person that stood up for me.
Uh-huh. And you were a conservation officer in Michigan. What was that job as related to police officer on the street?
It would be traditional to what we would call a game warden. So it was a very unique job.
Yeah.
Well, and there were only 200 in the state.
Yeah. Okay. So and then did you make the transition then into a police department?
I did. And when I left and became a police officer in Grand Rapids, Michigan, I was more accepted there. But it was very interesting because the senior officers that I had, they had the impression that the city was under a consent decree in order to hire minorities. And so what they felt is that what they were told is that the minority candidates took a different test than the white candidates had taken. It was just the opposite. We all took the same test. There were just three different lists, and they were selecting the officers from those lists, and that was the only difference that there was.
Mm-hmm. So when you joined the force, and were there coworkers or colleagues that thought that you took an easier test or something to get hired?
Oh, absolutely. That's exactly what they believed. And even though our scores might have been one thousandth of a point different, some would come back and say, well, you were still number 39th on the list. So they never gave you credit for your knowledge or your ability. It was that there was preference given.
Mm-hmm. So you were fighting the whole way against a preconceived idea of who they thought you were going to be.
Right. Not just there, it was my entire career. So every agency that I've been in, there was a perception. Even when I came here to Gainesville, the question was I, and I can recall one of the old guys asking me, are you a jitterbug, meaning was I a street person, or am I a police officer? And so there was a clear distinction in trying to determine who I was and what side of the law I'm going to be on.
Well, jitterbug, what you mean like street, what does that mean? I'm sorry.
Drug dealer.
Like you're getting into the force so you can do that?
Right. Being biased in favor of black folks and treating them in a different way than I would treat white folks, and giving black folks a break all the time. So that's kind of the way they looked at it. So it's always constantly proving yourself to show that you belong.
Yeah, but it's kind of like having to prove that you belong in one thing. But then did you find yourself also having to prove yourself to people in the black community that you still belong there, too?
You don't belong once you become a police officer. You are I can't repeat the things that I was told, the statements that were made to me. But basically what I was a race traitor. And so they had little respect for me. And in the white community, there was little respect for me. So you're kind of caught. It's a very divisive situation. It's a very interesting dynamic to be in.
It's kind of a lonely place to be right there in the middle.
It is.
And then I'm wondering how policing evolved in those 20 years that you spent in different police departments. How did you see things changing, or did they ever change?
Policing is kind of an interesting place because what it does is it comes up with great new ideas. They live with those ideas for a while, and then they abandon them. So we went from traditional policing to community policing. And in Gainesville, there was a very active community policing department. Actually, we had what we call COPS teams, which were three-person units that were assigned to particular geographical areas, and they handled all the crimes in those areas, but they also were responsible for basically working with the community to solve a lot of problems. And then we have kind of evolved back to, we've gotten away from community policing since 9/11, and we've gone back to traditional policing.
Which includes more profiling, things like that.
Right. And there are things that were never on our plate. I mean, when I started, we didn't have to worry about drug dealers that were had better firearms. We didn't have to worry about there were so many things that we never had to worry about. And as the criminal element became more sophisticated, we had to become more sophisticated in our efforts. And so, you know, it required body armor. It required people complain about the militarization of police with the military-style vehicles. Well, if you think about it, how else would you address some of the incidents that officers are involved in? The other part of that also becomes local law enforcement now is actively involved in some form of terrorism or intelligence gathering. These are things that we never had to do before. So it has evolved as the world takes a different stage. So has policing tried to adjust to that.
I want to talk a little bit more about community policing. It seems, in theory, like a great idea. But a lot of things in theory seem great. But then when in action, sometimes they don't work out. But did you see community policing working or heading towards working before it got abandoned?
It works if the agency is committed to it. I had the opportunity since I retired to travel around the country and do some assessments for organizations. And the question I often had is I'd ask them to define what community policing meant. From my perspective, it means a partnership with the community, that we are working together to solve a series of problems. But as I traveled around the country, it meant whatever the agency wanted it to mean. It was a buzzword. So that partnership wasn't necessarily what the agency was buying into.
Oh, yeah. Buzzwords are great. They really do evolve and change depending on where you go. Even diversity gets changed depending on what organization you're working with. I see community policing in my, you know, non-police person mind as a partnership between a community and the police officers where the community feels like it can trust the police officer to have their best interests at heart if they're operating in a legal way. Does that kind of make sense?
That's exactly what it is. Here in Gainesville, where I worked, in the neighborhood that I was assigned to, we literally could go up on the porch and sit down and talk to Ms. Jones or Mr. Smith, and you'd be amazed at the information that they would give you as far as the crimes that were occurring. The drug dealers, we knew by first name. And we'd literally sit down and talk to them and have conversations with them. So everybody knew everybody. And it was just a matter of time. And you tell the drug dealer, hey, you keep playing, keep doing what you're doing. We're going to get you. And that was literally, it was that open and about the way we were doing our business.
And I think that also leads to kind of understanding the regional culture. I think almost every neighborhood can have its own culture and its own hierarchy of people and different persons that are respected and not respected, and the police knowing where to go and who to talk to. I think that, you know, sounds to me like it would be helpful instead of treating an entire block as another.
Absolutely. I had a partner who was, believe it or not, a pharmacist that got sick of being a pharmacist and became a cop. And he was tied here to the University of Florida. And so the neighborhood that we worked in, what he did is he literally got the dental clinic to come to the neighborhood, and so that they would be able to give free dental clinic to the services to the people in the neighborhood. We ran a basketball camp in the summer. But if you think about community policing, it's very labor intensive, meaning that you have to have the personnel, you have to have the money, and you have to be committed to it. And right now, if you look at it, most agencies are struggling to get people. I do psych evals here, and I know that most of the agencies are short, and they're really struggling to kind of get quality personnel to come in.
So then eventually you decided to get out of law enforcement, and, you know, you just decided to go get a doctorate degree. Congratulations.
I mean, thank you.
What made you decide to do that?
Well, when I retired, I was 42. And so what do you do at 42 years old? My retirement wasn't enough for me to live off of. I got injured, and I was forced to retire due to a knee injury. So I took a medical retirement. And I was just finishing my master's degree. And as an adult learner, that was the most fun I ever had in school. And so I said, what the heck? I'm here. Let's finish it. So I enrolled at Union and got a PhD in forensic psych. I mean, literally, that's what drove the bus, because I was sitting there thinking what my next step would be. And all I ever wanted to do from the time I was teaching in the Law Enforcement Academy back in Michigan was to be a professor at once my career had ended.
So you wanted to be able to teach people. What drew you to forensic psychology? And what exactly is forensic psychology?
Forensic psychology is a broad topic. So it deals with police psychology. It deals with, believe it or not, child custody issues. It also addresses issues that deal with people who are injured, let's say, and to determine if they're malingering so that they can get medical or get benefits from their employer. And they oftentimes they'll fake the injury, so they use a psychologist to actually test them out to figure out if this person is actually injured or are they legitimately – is this a fake? Mm-hmm. So it's a gamut of stuff. My original thing was is I wanted to figure out why people did the stuff that they do. And having been a cop for 20 years and putting people in jail, I kind of wanted to peep the other side and see what was going on. That was the driving force.
I think it's so interesting. Do you ever find yourself kind of like analyzing why police behave the way that they do and why maybe the people throughout your policing career behave the way that they did towards you and towards minority communities?
That is, I think, of all the things, that's probably the easiest thing when we talk about that part of it. And there's a historical perspective that dates back, you know, back to slavery. The most interesting part of that conversation to me is that my dad, I graduated from college, and I can remember him looking at me and calling me a useless human being because I decided to be a police officer. He couldn't understand that. He says, of all the things that you could do in this world, you chose to do that. I couldn't see myself doing anything else, and I tried to explain to him that there were no jobs, and that just didn't register because he thought there were just so many other things that I could do.
Mm-hmm. So you alluded there a little bit to the history. The oppression of minorities by law enforcement has got some very real and documented roots in our country. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, if we go back to slavery, it actually, you know, the sheriff's patrols, those slave patrols, those were run by the sheriff. And if we go historically, you can look at almost every incident or major incident. I say that probably the more recent one, and I don't know if all the listeners even remember this or if they're old enough to remember, kind of begins with Rodney King. That kind of was the first pervasive outshowing because that was the first time something was videotaped and then it was put out where the public saw exactly what happened. That kind of validated all of the things that the minority community have been saying for years, the abuses that have been going on. And so people would say, this is what actually happens. Now, today, you see it time and time again because officers forget that people don't have video, that they have phones with video cameras on them. And so that becomes the documentation and being able to put it upload it and get it online is a killer. It is actually has made the relationships much worse.
Well, I think it's really interesting. You mentioned the Rodney King. I remember that very vividly. It really seemed like it was quite a turning point. And now it seems very frequently we are seeing videos that are just very disturbing of police behavior towards minorities. Do you, and I don't know how the data would show this out, is it happening more frequently now or are we just seeing it more now because everybody's got a video camera in their hand?
I think what you'll see, what I can honestly say is that it's not happening more frequently. I agree with you that it is happening. You see it more because the everyday, every person has the ability to record it. And so, and that actually becomes, I've watched some videos where there have been officer-involved shootings where people have taken their own life, put their lives in danger just to record the incident rather than ducking down and being safe. So, yeah, it's that important. It has become, it's the catalyst for this conflict that goes on every day.
Well, and that just kind of sows that distrust even further.
Yeah.
You know, between the minority community and the police. And there are police officers, there are many, many police officers who don't engage in that.
Right. I would tell you that maybe 1 or 2% that make bad decisions, those are the ones that are videotaped, and those are literally the ones that everybody sees. And nobody gets credit for the good work that they do.
And that's a problem. Like we mentioned in the beginning that police officers want to be respected, and both sides do. in the situation.
Right.
But they're just continuously, like, they keep on pushing further away from one another.
And the other thing that drives me nuts, if you think about it, law enforcement used to be a great, it used to just keep its mouth shut. But now it has become so, they become just as bad as the other side. So they've actually lost that professionalism. And so they have started to use social media to make a point, to stand up. And with Blue Lives Matter, I have no problem with that. But there has to be some point at which they stand up and they do it at a professional level, not like they did in San Francisco when Colin Kaepernick made a stand with kneeling. They refused to understand or recognize why that even took place and where he even how he decided to make that decision, that choice that he made. What they wanted to do, and the sad part about the letter that the union wrote, it just says maybe he should be more concerned about the homicides that are occurring in the black community as opposed to dealing with what goes on between police and the black community.
Yeah, deflection. If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Dr. David Thomas. He's a justice studies professor at FGCU and the author of the book, State of American Policing. If you'd like to add your voice to our conversation, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook or at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter or at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, I mean, there have the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, and the riots that followed are a really big example of these high-profile cases. How closely do you follow each of these cases and the impact that those cases have? Do you use these as teaching points in your coursework?
Sure. I'll take it a step further. I get the opportunity to do analysis of a lot of cases for agencies or for the media. And so I get the case files, and literally what I do with those is I actually put those in my classes because I want my students to understand what some of the issues are and that it's just not what – it's not the media spread. It is the actual case reports so that they actually can read and understand where the mistakes are made and make decisions about what needs to be changed. If they were going to be police officers, what would they change? So that's how I spend a great deal of my time.
And tell me a little bit about police training. Has the way that police officers are trained changed over the years to try to address some of these issues of police violence towards minorities?
Well, in the 90s in Florida, we had diversity training. And the chiefs and the officers hated it so much that they did away with it. And so there's not much in the area of diversity that actually goes on and trying to get people to understand. I've taught in classes where race has become an issue in the actual recruit class. So the reality is that we need to figure out. I did a training for an agency here called the Alachua Police Department, and I titled it after the name of my book. But what I did is every quarter I went in and did a section. And so one of the things that I spent time with this agency with was the subject of implicit bias. And I had them take – Harvard has a test, an implicit bias test. So I actually put them – made them go online and take the test. And I figured their scores would be, you know, everybody would have about the same score, which they actually did. There was not much bias that came out during the test. Interestingly enough, what I did with them is I actually asked them had they ever dealt with Black Lives Matter? Do they know what Black Lives Matter was all about? And all they could tell me is that they don't like us. So I said, have you ever taken an opportunity to go look at their website? Nope, don't need to. I said, well, that's what we're going to do here. So I bring up that information and I put it in the classroom. And I forced them to have an open discussion about Black Lives Matter. But then I also bring up the other side. I bring up the white supremacist organizations or Antifa, which is another group that cares less about anybody. And I put those up so that they actually get an opportunity to have open discussions and can kind of air out whatever feelings they're having. And like I told them, I recognize as a black man, as a 63-year-old black man, I recognize that that Black Lives Matter, you consider that to be a threat. But and from my perspective, I look at what they're offering or their argument, and I said some of it I agree with. Some of it is absolute nonsense. So you literally you have to wade through and take the time to become objective about your opinions and stay off the police blogs and stop letting them make up your mind for you.
Well, there's that whole echo chamber effect that we've all, you know, become victimized by at some point, I'm sure, in our opinion formation. Right. But one of the things that you mentioned that I found kind of interesting is you've written about teaching around an article written 20 years ago by a man named Brian Bain. It was published in the Village Voice. It's called The Bill of Rights for Black Men Walking While Black. I think that one thing that a lot of people and that are white that they just may not understand what it's like to walk around as a black person who is seen as somebody who doesn't like us and who is a threat. So you said that the police officers found the Black Lives Matter movement as somebody who doesn't like us and they're a threat to us. But sometimes people paint the entire race in that way.
That is correct. And that's what you try to get them to understand and to be discriminatory in their decision making and their opinions and basically judge people on their merits as opposed to what they look like. And that's very difficult. I kind of have an in because a lot of the people around here I've trained. So there's a respect factor that goes into it. And I don't have an agenda. I want them, the idea is to get them to be objective. So what the officers do is they trust me in order to be able to broach the subject. And if we have to have, I've had some heated discussions with officers, but it's all healthy. It's great, healthy debate.
And it's interesting that you were raised in Detroit, Michigan, which I consider kind of part of the Midwest. I mean, it's the middle, definitely, a little further to the north. But I was raised also in the Midwest. And I was talking with one of my colleagues earlier today about race in the, you know, late 70s, 80s, 90s. That was a time when people were raised to – white people were raised to try to be colorblind and not see anything. The black people that – went to our schools that we interacted with, we didn't see a whole lot of their culture. I'm wondering if for black people at that time, they were raised to or they were taught in some ways to kind of fly under the radar and not display their culture and not display their. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying. And I will call it a biphasic personality, so to speak. On one side of that, you have to do what mainstream America does in order to be accepted. And so your culture is placed in the back on the back burner. On the other side of that, when you get home, you're allowed to be that person. And that was one of the things when I was raised as a kid in Detroit. That was one of the things my mom always taught me is that when you're in school or when you're in public, you're to act a certain way. When you're with your friends, you can act another way. And if you look at corporate America, this whole thing about diversity and natural hair, all of that stuff now is accepted because of the way America, some of the trends in America have gone. In the old days, black folks wouldn't even listen to their stories of black folks turning off of their music when they got to as before they would get to work. So people would not acknowledge. So them being black would not become an issue.
It's just now it feels like things are different in many ways where I feel like there's more curiosity and interest in learning about different cultures and a bit more of an embracing of it, but then it seems like there is still a segment of the population that wants to retreat backwards from that.
And I would agree with you, and I would say that there's a certain degree of divisiveness in the subject matter. I had a white chief tell me not too long ago. He goes, "Man, you're the greatest." He said, "But," and they're only going to let you. He says, "And a lot of people respect you, but the reality is they're only going to let you in so far, Dave." And because they're not going to give you the keys to the station, so to speak. He said, and that's what's always going to limit you, is your race is always going to be a factor in this.
Do you feel like that's still the case, or do you think that's more particular to police?
I would say that it's still the case. I would say that when you think about African Americans, you think about blacks, you think about other cultures, that in this country, you have to weave your way into the fabric. There's no guarantee, though, that you are going to be accepted. There's always, I can tell you right now that in a black man's in his mindset, the reality is that you're always fighting to be accepted by your peers. You just want to be a part of the group. And that's very, it becomes very, at times it's very divisive. And look at it from, we talk about in the field of policing, just so that you can understand, there are subcultures within policing where we have females, we have minority males, we have, and we have white males. And then we can take it a step further where it's broken down by race. And so when you look at the race, you look at, let's say, a black male, that black male is struggling to be accepted by his white peers because that is the standard. That is the standard in most police agencies. So that fight is to be accepted. When a new minority comes into that batch, then everybody looks, all the other minorities look at that minority and they go, you know, I wonder what kind of person he or she is going to be, because they literally could embarrass us and they would set us back in our reputation, everything that we worked for, because we're looked at collectively as a group, not as individuals.
Well, we're seeing that also with religious groups in our country right now, too, with people being feeling like when a terrorist act happens, it feels like, well, that's representative of everybody in that particular religious group as well. And one person representing an entire race or an entire group of people, it's tough, but it does hurt with the optics when things like that happen or when somebody acts in a certain way. Your book gives a great overview of the history of policing in this country, and it might feel like they've always been part of our society, but that's not really the case. Can you give me a quick breakdown of when what we would think of as a police department first became a thing?
It was back in the 1800s, and it was, I believe, New York City was the first police department. Oddly enough, the it's interesting because, and I'll come back to that, when I was in the academy in 1978, I watched a video. And the Academy showed us a video, and it was a New York City commander. And he talked about their role in policing was to divide or to keep the rich people, to protect the rich people from the poor people. The reality is, if you go back and you think about policing when policing first started, that's exactly what the purpose of policing was. It started out with guys that were hoodlums, and their whole thing was to fight and to keep the peace. But as it evolved, it was to separate or keep the rich and the wealthy protected, and to keep the dregs of society or the poor people away from them, keep them in order. And that was their job, their role. That was policing's role. And in its own way, not to say that things are the same, but you see that happen in minority communities. You see it where black man's walking down the street, like Byron was in the book, and he gets stopped. Or you see a black man riding a bicycle at night with no light, and he gets stopped and written a citation. And the idea is that because he's a black man, he's out at night, he has no light on his bike. I get it. He's got no light on his bike, and that's a violation of the law. But what we're looking for, what law enforcement is looking for, are warrants, and they're looking for drugs and weapons. And so that just gives them probable cause in order to be able to do those other things, i.e. search the person. So it's always that check and balance. It's always there's always a belief in the community that law enforcement has one job, and that's to keep that part of the society separate, to protect us from them.
Mm-hmm. There's another thing from your book that you mentioned is called black hysteria. What does that term mean?
Black hysteria, I got to thinking about it because every time I have friends who are not law enforcement, and every time there's a shooting, then the first thing everybody screams that it is an act of racism. And nobody's ever taken time to sit back and look at the facts. Michael Brown's shooting in Ferguson is a classic case. I went so far as a friend of mine, Dr. Fackler, who was one of the world's leading pathologists in Gainesville, we actually sat down and went through that case. And he went through every aspect of that case. We sat and we talked. And based on all of the evidence, the shooting was actually a good shooting. But when you think about they rioted because of Michael Brown, but what happens is they skew the facts. The facts are skewed. The facts don't matter. And so it's what happens with people with black folks is there's this loss of connection and looking at the facts. And I know part of it is they don't trust the facts, but really that's where you make your argument. That's where you start to tear the facts apart. That's where you start to become analytical to look to find out if what the police are saying is actually true. When we get lost and we don't do that, then nobody listens because people, if you think about it, the minority community, the black community has been yelling for years that police have been abusing them and that the system is against them. So without that argument, without being scientific about it, all you're doing is screaming, crying wolf.
Well, I got to be honest. When you say that, when you describe that feeling of being so outraged by something that's been going on that when one thing happens, you'll take it all the way as far as you can. I think we're all kind of feeling that way, not to trivialize the experience of an entire race, but sometimes just people just want to really just rage against a system that does not seem to be serving them, and they have an opportunity to do so and make a statement. That's when they want to do it.
And I don't have a problem with that. The only thing I'm saying is that When you argue the elements based on the science, argue the elements based on the law.
Because it's a stronger argument then.
Yes, because then nobody can say that you're crying wolf and they just can't discount you. And that's where you have to be in order to get people to listen to you.
So we're about out of time. I wanted to ask you, do you have any final thoughts before I let you go?
I'll kind of sum it up. In the last chapter of the book, I talk about there are two deputy sheriffs that were killed here in Gilchrist County. They were murdered. They having dinner and a guy walked up to him and he shot him. And I remember the sheriff, and I know the sheriff, I met him, and I remember the sheriff standing there and he talked about the divisiveness in this country and how it had to change. And he made several statements and I'm like, man, you know, let's get off of that bandwagon and let's start talking about, we need to figure out a way to make these things not happen. We need to figure out a way to work with our communities, da-da-da-da-da. And there are a lot of times where we have missed some of these golden opportunities. And like I said, we got to sit at the table and start talking because the police aren't going anywhere and these communities aren't. And all we can do is we can be at each other's throat or we can sit down to kind of resolve some of these issues.
Exactly. Well, that's all the time that we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. David Thomas, a justice studies professor at FGCU and author of the book, The State of American Policing. Dr. Thomas, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
When we return, a team of researchers have discovered a new species of salamander up in the swamps of the Florida Panhandle in southern Alabama. I'm Julie Glenn. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.